at the beginning of the meditation, quite honestly, hadn't got a clue what I was going to talk about. But just as I mentioned a word, just to learn about how to make peace and be at ease and comfortable with your own mind, and how the mind, when it's at peace, creates a very relaxed and healthy body. It sort of started me being reminded that this thing which we call the mind, many people say its name, many people talk about it, but very few people know what it truly is, and just how powerful this mind can be for so many different benefits. And even just a couple of days ago, someone showed me an article about athletes, especially cyclists, who were running races up in the mountains so high that the oxygen level was only half as much oxygen as down in the level plains. And even though that sometimes they needed oxygen bottles to be able to ride their bicycles because they weren't able to breathe in enough oxygen to satisfy the exertion of their legs on their bicycle. Some doctors, they tried a few experiments on these cyclists. They tried giving them empty bottles. And some of the cyclists didn't even notice they were empty. They were still being able to cycle as if they were getting oxygen from the bottle. It was like a placebo effect. They were wondering, how can that work? I remember years ago seeing other articles of people who had problems with their knees, and the doctors would put them under anesthetic, do an incision on their knee, sew it up again immediately without doing anything to their knee, putting a bandage on, and they got better. That placebo effect, the nature of the mind being able to influence the health of the body, is again very well known. But what is this mind, and how can we get to know this mind so well that we can make use of these things? And it's like this mind, we know it's very powerful. We don't know really what it is or where to find it. It is because of that that I adapted, really a lot of adaption, to a simile of the Buddha, of the, and I called it the simile of the emperor. And in this simile, this metaphor, there was an emperor who was so powerful, so strong and influential, but no one knew who the emperor was. Every time the emperor appeared in public or in front of the TV screen, the emperor was covered with five garments, was covered with boots which went halfway past his knees up to his thighs. And then over the boots were these trousers which overlapped the top of the boots and went up way past his waist. And over the top of his body, from the neck covering down to the overlapping the trousers and down to the wrist, I just said his, we didn't even know if it was a he, there was his jacket. On the hands was gloves which overlapped the end of the jacket sleeves, and on top of his head was this huge helmet. So every part of his body was covered, and where the different garments met, those garments overlapped, so no one could see what this emperor was, whether it was male or female, whether it was Asian or African or Irish or Australian. They didn't know who the emperor was. But it was very important to find out, because this emperor was incredibly powerful. So how can you find out what this emperor is? The only way is to take off those five pieces of clothing, to remove the trousers, the boots, the jacket, the gloves and the helmet, to see what's inside. And then you can see exactly what this powerful emperor called your mind truly is. In that simile, the five pieces of clothing, it's only a simile, it's not me doing anything rude or naughty. I'm a monk, I'm a very sensitive monk. So I don't do anything rude or nasty like that. But the simile is you take away the five coverings of your mind. And those five coverings are seeing or sight, hearing, tasting, smelling, and physical touch. When those five things disappear, when they're no longer there, what's left? You know, there are times when you don't see things, when you close your eyes. There are times even when you don't hear. Smelling, tasting is pretty easy to stop. But times when the whole body vanishes and you can't feel any sensations at all. What's the best way of achieving or experiencing that? Obviously death, but that's going a bit too far just for the experiment of finding out what this inside emperor truly is. But the other way is like what we've just been doing for half an hour, meditating. You may have noticed when a person does meditate, they close their eyes and after a very short while you can't see anything. I say after a short while because when you first close your eyes you see the inside of your eyelids, but that's not important. So that sense of sight vanishes. And at this point I usually bring up this experience I had when I was a lay person, when I was meditating wherever I could find a place to meditate, and this was in a Zen monastery in the north of England. And in this Zen monastery I didn't know what I was supposed to do. They just, you know, in the little hall, which is a converted cow shed, that we sat down and we had to meditate with our eyes open. It was one of the first times I'd meditated with my eyes wide open. I didn't know what I was supposed to do, but I just meditated. But because I'd done some meditation before and I knew how to be in the present moment and stop this inner speech, as I was just with my eyes open, just being very peaceful, very calm, a strange thing happened. One of those weird experiences which show you there's more to this world than you'd thought. And at this time, I was a theoretical physicist. When I just looked at this wall, just a whitewashed wall, then, suddenly without warning, the wall disappeared. It vanished. It just wasn't there anymore. Which was so weird. One minute there was a wall, solid, and now there was nothing there. And of course, instead of getting scared or think I was going crazy, I used, you know, what we do in Buddhism called insight. What's happening? And it soon became very clear to me that this is just the nature of the physical senses, especially the sense of seeing, sight. If you watch something, put your full attention on watching, and what you observe doesn't move or change, it disappears. The sense of sight turns off. Of course, in those days I never had many similes, but today one of the best similes is the computer screen. You may have your screensaver on there, beautiful picture, and then you don't touch the mouse, no one touches anything, and after a little while the screensaver turns off. Bit of efficiency, not wasting energy. And that's what sight does. If nothing moves, the sense of sight turns off. If you're in a silent place, or a place where there's very little background noise, no ambient, the ambient level of noise is even. It doesn't have to be perfectly quiet. Although I must admit though that I've been in some places, or some caves, or some monasteries, or some places in even European forests in the winter time when no one is around, or in the Australian bush, and sometimes you get up early in the morning and there's no wind and everything is just so silent and peaceful. Sometimes that external quiet just turns off my hearing. In other words, the sense of hearing disappears. Smell and taste are very easy to turn off. One of the hardest of the five senses to turn off is your bodily sense, the sense of touch. But just doing some meditation. And again, I'm a 69-year-old male, just my body should be a pain in the butt, and anywhere, everywhere else actually. But when you meditate, you just put the body down, you relax it as best you can. It's never perfect, but after a while, the body vanishes. It disappears. You can't feel your knees, you can't feel your guts, you can't feel your butt. I can feel my butt now. There's huge pressure, you know, because I'm a monk with gravitas, I say. A very, very rounded figure. In other words, fat. But it's a happy fat. And so there's a lot of weight on my butt. And I can feel the pressure now, but when you meditate, you don't feel anything. The whole feeling disappears. So the whole body just, you can't feel anything. It's such a beautiful experience just to let go of that sense of physical touch. You're sitting there, your eyes closed, you can't hear anything. Although the sound of this air conditioner on heating, because it's cold today, is right next to me. I can hear this now, but when I was meditating, I couldn't hear a thing. Because your sense of sound turned off. So when you actually learn how to calm down all those senses, calming down so nothing moves, nothing changes, then after a while they disappear. This is the art of meditation. You don't have to do anything, just keep things still, motionless, unchanging, and they disappear by themselves. So you can't feel your body, you can't hear any sounds, you're not seeing, smelling, or tasting anything. There's five senses, there's five pieces of clothing which hide the emperor. I just call it the emperor because the mind is incredibly powerful inside. And the first thing about that, the emperor, is it male or female? Ha ha ha. Hasn't got gender. Anything to do with gender, male, female, or any of the genders in between, all of those genders are to do with your body. When you get to the mind, there's no gender at all. It's a beautiful experience because it answers many, many, many questions. Sometimes that people have arguments. Can a Buddha, maybe the next Buddha, can the next Buddha be female? Why not? Because in truth the Buddha's not male nor female, it's to do with the mind, an awakened mind, which has not got a gender, it's not got a race, it's not got a country of origin, hasn't even got an age. It's something beyond those things. And this is something which is not theory or nice speech just to inspire people. This is what you feel, what you know, when the five senses disappear and you go into the world of the mind. So, that world of the mind which appears through meditation, when you get to know this powerful mind, it has great effect on your happiness and sickness. Oh, so many times that, you know, I should have been sick. So many times I was sick. and using meditation to overcome that sickness. Just to let the body just disappear for a while. Oh, I usually tell these stories to the monks, but why not this evening? That in my first or second year as a monk, this was 43 years ago, in northeast Thailand. And like many of the monks, or Western monks in this area, I got a fever one day, and no one knew what it was. It was actually scrub typhus fever. I only found that out a few years later. You found it out because there was one doctor, one Thai doctor, who'd always come and offer food to the monastery, and he noticed all these monks were getting sick. Only got sick once, and you know, this fever, and he said, this is like typhoid fever or typhus fever. And he checked in the health authority, he said, no, there's no scrub typhus in that part of Thailand. And so after a little bit of effort and a little bit of investigation, you know, he said, well, maybe these are Westerners. Maybe the locals have got immunity over many, many generations. And of course, he was totally right. All the local villagers, they get bitten by these mites in the forest, these tiny little bugs, which you could hardly see. But they were immune. They'd got their immunity from generation to generation. But the Westerners, we got the fever. But I do remember just how unpleasant that experience was. Fortunately, I was young. Because I was young, you were just full of 24, 25, you know, energy, feel you're invulnerable, but you're really sick. I just remember the first night when I was in that hospital. It was the monk's ward of this hospital. People were very kind, but it was just very basic. So it was one of these wards with six beds on either side of roughly, and it was a nurse's station. And I always remember just the fear which arose just when the nurse disappeared at 6 p.m. I did know enough Thai to ask the monk in the next bed, the night nurse hasn't appeared yet. Should we go and tell somebody? And he looked at me with disbelief. What are you talking about? A night nurse. There is no night nurse in this hospital. They only work from 7 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night, that's all. What happens if some of us get sick at night, if we have a medical crisis? Oh, it's just unlucky karma, that's all. And that attitude of just saying it's unlucky karma was not very encouraging. And it was there later on. Oh, I have to mention the nurse. The nurses are wonderful people, male nurses, female nurses. But this one nurse who used to come to the monk's ward to inject me with antibiotic, I'll never forget her. I can even picture her now. I was a young monk just learning my meditation, trying to be kind to all beings. But I have to confess, in all honesty, whenever I did my loving-kindness meditation or chanting in the morning or evening, I always made exceptions. May all beings be happy and well, but not her. And you know why? Oh, it was just so hard. She would come twice a day to inject me on the bottom. I was going to say the bum, but I shouldn't say the bum because that's a rude word to say the bum. On the bottom. Oops, I've just said it three times. To inject me. And these were the days when they had recyclable needles. So they'd use them in Bangkok, first of all. And having used them in Bangkok and not being able to sharpen them anymore, they'd send them up to the provinces, and Ubon was one of those provinces, the country bumpkins, they sometimes called them, the right word for them in their translating from Thai into Isan, northeastern into English. And they said, just, they use them in the ordinary wards first of all, and then the last place they'd use them in the monks' ward, because we were tough, especially the forest monks. We're the tough people. And that was true, because I remember just going to give blood a few times. They never give you any anesthetic, they just put the thing in. And she said, oh, you're a forest monk, you don't mind a bit of pain. They could have asked. Anyway, so she'd come twice a day with these dull old needles to inject my bottom. And it wasn't an injection. The needles I have these days to inject you, they're just so painless. Use them once and they throw them away. These ones, I kept on using them, so they're pretty dull by the time they got into your backside. And she never injected them, never injected. Stabbed. Oh, that really hurt. Especially after about 3 or 4 weeks, twice a day. My butt was so sore. So I just, you know, it was a failure. I should give loving kindness to all beings. But I must admit that was very hard. But anyway, while I'm saying all this, was that was also, I can't miss this opportunity. When Ajahn Chah came to visit, you can imagine I've been there for a couple of weeks and not getting better at all, still having the fever, no one knew what was wrong. And then Ajahn Chah, my teacher, came to visit me and I felt just you might say special that he'd taken the time out to visit me. Oh, it's so wonderful. And he came by my bedside and he said, Brahma Wangsa. I said, yeah, I wanted some kindness. And he said, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. Then he turned around and left. Oh, sometimes I don't know. At the time I thought, if that's what you're going to say, but not to come here. But you know, you can't argue that that was so true. And as it was, as you can see, I got better. But I do remember one of the times. And I wish I had been a bit more mindful, but I can understand why I wasn't, because I had such incredibly low energy. Never had so much low energy as that time. Fever for about 3 or 4 weeks. And anyway, that one day I got sort of depressed, but not a depression which was negative. I don't know that. I thought, oh, this is really awful, nothing's working, this is terrible. So why don't I do some meditation? And actually practice, you know, what my teacher would teach me, what the Buddha would say. Do something useful. Now this was like 3 weeks or 4 weeks into a very heavy fever. And nothing was working, feeling just so exhausted. So I decided to meditate, and obviously not cross-legged, but just laying on the bed, laying on my back, or half on my back, half on this, half on that, and being able just to let go of my body. And it was just a wonderful experience, just sitting there, laying there, with legs all over the place. If you've seen people in hospital with a fever, they're not really caring about just how their body is positioned, you're all over the place. But then just going deep inside, away from my body, closing my eyes. It was in a ward of a hospital, so there's lots of noise there, but I couldn't hear anything. No smell, no taste, just going inside to some nice, beautiful mind state. Oh, it was just a wonderful time. And I'm pretty sure that would be when the fever stopped. Simply because that's the nature of the mind. It's incredibly powerful, and it's so powerful inside, it just stops all this stuff in your body. And very happy afterwards, the negativity, oh, that went. And also showed me that those meditations are possible, even when you're sick. Because I wasn't told they're not possible. A lot of times people think, oh, you can't do it when you're sick, it's impossible, so they don't even try. It's not actually trying, it's just letting go. And taking off those 5 garments so you can see what this real mind is. And the mind isn't sick, it's just the body is sick. When the mind is accessed and come powerful, it can do huge things for your own body and heal it. And so a lot of times, even the Buddha said, the only times is when he became very old and lots of aches and pains all over the place, the only time he could have some peace was going into the deep meditations, away from the body. And it just showed you some of the power of this thing which we call our mind. I know what it actually is. It is true that for some people they always thought, the mind doesn't exist. And these are scientists who should really be ashamed of their thinking of scientific credentials. I often mention, having been, you know, a scientist myself, I still am a scientist, and having known things like quantum theory, just how much the mind is involved in the nature of our world. You can't exclude it. And I don't know why some people try to. It's one of the reasons why one of the definitions of materialism, this is philosophy, but it's very simple to understand. Why did I say that? Philosophy, simple to understand. Sometimes philosophy, or any of these things, is explained so badly that people think it's complicated. But this is just the definition of materialism in philosophy. Materialism is just taking this stuff here, and the mind is just some byproduct of stuff. And what happens when stuff vanishes? What happens when the body disappears? In deep meditation, where you're perfectly alert, perfectly awake, and you know exactly what's going on inside, you're accessing this thing which we call the mind. And this body, yeah, you come back to it afterwards, but the body does feel like just a car, like a vehicle which you use. But it's not, you know, really who you are. But it's a vehicle which you use and which you can drive all around wherever you need to go, but which is wonderful to be able to leave it when you need to leave it. And it answers a lot of questions. Even just today, just before coming here, I just conducted a little funeral service for people I've known since, actually, their mum, just before they were born. And so it's wonderful having been here in Australia for Perth for over 36 years, it's the 37th year I've been here. Hey, hang on a minute, because I came on WASAC in 1983. So this is 37 years now. 37 years in Australia. But some of these people I've known since, you know, before they were born, seen them grow up, seen them get married, seen them sort of going through their life together and having their own kids. It's a great privilege having known these Buddhist families for such a long time. But for them to understand that when a person dies, it's only the body dies. And this mind just continues on. And that's one of the reasons why that people can actually see people when they're dead. Can actually even feel them or hear them. Ghosts. But ghosts aren't scary. I don't know why people are so afraid of ghosts. It's not even supernatural. It's natural. This is what happens when a person dies. Their body disappears, but their mind is just still there, still alert, sometimes confused if you don't know what's going on. I don't know if you've heard of people who have out-of-the-body experiences, you know, when they just have a bad accident or something, or they're on an operating table and the operation sort of goes wrong. What's one of those cases? Oh, this one case was of this young man. I was a boy about 5, 6, 7 years of age. He told me this story at length. And he was having some operation. This was many years ago in Yugoslavia, when Yugoslavia was just one country. And he was having an operation and he died on the operating table. And he described just how he was floating out of his body, and he could see that the doctors who were operating on him were looking at the wrong place. They weren't seeing where the problem was. And so he said that's where he was like dying, or he was actually dead outside of his body. And then he said all he did, a 5 or 6 year old boy, that's how old he was, he just thought the doctors, you know, he couldn't speak outside of his body, but just thought, doctor, don't look over here, look over there. And immediately that's what the doctor did. And he shouted out, hey, here's a problem. And because they could see what the problem was, that they solved the problem and he was fine again. He recovered. But, he said to me, and he told me this story, he was one of my students meditating in Carnap prison farm many years ago. He was a convict in the jail. And he said, but he didn't really mind being a convict, he said, because ever since that time, he came back into his body, but whenever he wanted to leave his body, he could. He could do the old astral traveling, make up a mind-made body, as we say in Buddhism, and he could leave his body. So he said, whenever he wanted to watch a football match, didn't matter what prison they put him in, he'd just leave his body and go and watch. If he wanted to go and see a concert by someone in Perth, he didn't even need to book tickets. He'd just go there in his astral body and just get, you know, front seat view. And the way he said it and all the other information he gave me, he said, yes, okay, I think that's pretty accurate what he was saying. So this is knowing that there's something else apart from this physical body, this mind. And it is powerful because you're in this body for a while, but it gets older, it gets sicker, and it falls apart. We have all the problems with, you know, the gender and status and race and stuff, and all that stuff just disappears. When you know that's just your make of car, your vehicle which you're driving in, but your mind, that's where all the real action is. And that's the place where we access in our deep meditations. And this is not theory anymore, this is something which you actually do, you experience again and again and again. And it's also, because it's free of this body, it's also incredibly happy. Because the body is like a burden for you. Even if you've got a young, fit, healthy body, like me. No, it's not fit and healthy. It's young, it's really getting old. Actually, the funeral I went to today, the person who died is the same age as me, 69. But she wasn't a monk. But anyway, when a person does get old, it's just the body getting old. The mind is something else. And you can always, and your body gets sick, your body gets achy, even your body gets tired, the mind is something totally different. And people ask, well, what actually is it? And at this point, that it's a little sort of party trick, which I can't do here because it's mostly an empty hall today, just a few of the workers are here today, just the AV team and stuff. But just sometimes I ask people a little trick and I say, are you happy or are you disappointed today? And sometimes, you know, the halls which I give talks in, sometimes when there's no COVID, there's sometimes thousands of people in those halls. So it's a very good trick to do. And I said, if you're happy, put up your right hand. If you're miserable, put up your left hand. And one of them you must put up. And be honest. And see all these hands going up. I said, keep them up. Now with your finger, please, if you're happy, please point to that happiness for me. Point to it. If you're miserable, point to it. And it's a wonderful thing to see people. I wish they would actually film that, because they go pointing here, there, all over the place. Because they have trouble locating a simple thing which they've known for so many years, happiness. When you're happy, where is it? Is it in your heart or is it in your head? If you're, say, let's do the opposite, miserable, if you're really angry, where is the anger? It's in him. He's causing it. No, these things belong to your mind, not your heart. It's not your physical heart. When you're in love, your whole body's in love. When you're depressed, where's depression? What part of your body is depression in? You find you can't point to it. Which is one of the important parts, one important arguments, that these things don't live in the body. These things live in the mind. Just like if you want to know what is a garden is where you find beautiful bushes, flowers, trees. These are the sorts of things which define the word garden. Not buildings, not concrete, not, you know, well, sometimes you have what they call hard landscaping, but no, a real garden and into these beautiful natural things. The mind is defined by the things which live in it. Things like joy, things like happiness, even laughter. Laughter is not part of the brain. Laughter is part of the mind. Inspiration. Have you ever been so inspired, sometimes you like to cry? Those tears of inspirational joy, where do they come from? Where are they? And they come from your mind. Which is why old people, young people, sick people, people about to die, they can still laugh with joy. Amazing to see. I've seen that and it's true. But it's because it's not coming from the sick body, it's coming from the mind, which has joy and happiness. So it's important to know that. That shows that there's some places in this world, some places in this body. In this body, there's some things which we just haven't really explored, the nature of the mind. And of course, how the mind can affect the real world of stuff. The PEAR project, P-E-A-R, Princeton Education or something. But anyway, that lots of people have been just trying to find out, is this really true? Can the mind change like random number generators? And of course it can. It has been proven. The evidence is there. This is not coming from brains. This is coming from minds interfering with natural rules of science. Brilliant to see. Great professors. I really admire them. Because actually what they have to prove takes far more evidence than usual criteria of proof. Anyway, to go back to the nature of the mind, that's what we cultivate more and more in this path we call Buddhism or spirituality. To purify the mind, to strengthen it, making it really powerful. And that's, you know, where in our meditation, if we have some really nice meditation, very peaceful, still meditation, then what happens is you get energized. You get power. I don't know, I think, because I've been here for such a long time in Perth, and I basically decided how we're going to be doing the teachings on a Friday evening, do some meditation first and then the talk. You know, to be, you know, quite truthful, one of the reasons I do this is because, you know, for half an hour, yeah, I'm leading you meditating, but that's just stuff I always say, but I'm meditating myself. And when I meditate and get very peaceful and still, oh, you get so much energy and joy coming up. So that's what powers any talks which I give. The peace, the joy from that little half an hour of meditation, which means your mindfulness, your awakeness is very strong. Which also means you can perceive so much joy and depth in whatever is going on. Oh, the story which comes up in my mind, I always tell this story, it seems, when I teach a meditation retreat at Jhana Grove, but I'm not at Jhana Grove today. That's our meditation retreat center. This is the road which goes up to Bodhinyana Monastery, Kingsbury Drive. And this event happened after I'd been living there for about 7 years. And in those 7 years of living there, it was a lot of work, building and cleaning and teaching and doing so much work. But I've been going up and down that road maybe 3 or 4 times a day on average. Oh, sorry, no, 3 or 4 times a week on average. But this day, I think I'd been giving a talk somewhere and stayed overnight and somebody picked me up from the train in the morning. And I had time. It was a beautiful spring morning, not hot, blue skies, but not totally blue, like sometimes the empty skies can be burning, you know, too hot here in Western Australia. This was a cool, beautiful day with some those cotton wool clouds just drifting over, white, just drifting over the hillside. And I asked my driver, please, can you let me out of the car? I'm going to walk up the hill today. And he eventually let me out. And I walked up, it's only 2.2 kilometers from the bottom of the hill up to the monastery where I was living. I had plenty of time. I was not trying to conquer the hill or beat some record. I was just ambling up at a nice, comfortable pace, enjoying the scenery. But that's when I got very shocked, because what I was seeing was totally different than anything I remember viewing through the window of a car. Walking up that hill was like walking in a different hillside. I saw so much detail, so much beautiful green grass and the little creek in the bottom of the valley and the trees and the... I don't think there was any cows in those days there, it was just sheep. And I could see all this wonderful wildlife and grasses and trees and bushes. And how come I'd never seen that before? How come I'd missed that? And then I just stopped. I was just so in awe of what I was experiencing and seeing. I stopped and just stared. I didn't move. And at that, the hillside just went to another level of beauty. You could see these individual blades of grass, just so green, like fluorescent, and rocks with the lichen on them, and the tree barks, and little animals, and things going around. And it was so gorgeous. It was one of those moments you just don't want to tear yourself away to walk up to the monastery. The monastery was right there, just so much beauty and detail. But whenever you enjoy something like that, you always have, you know, what we call the insight practice. So you have stillness and peace, but why? What is happening? And of course, I soon figured it out. What was happening was, when you were watching through the window of a car, you may think it's going slow, but it's still going at least 30, 40, 50 kilometers an hour up the hill. And what is actually happening to your eyes? You're being bombarded by one vision after another vision after another vision, because the car is going fast. And then your eyes don't have time. That's all it really is, just time. Because how your eye sees is a chemical reaction on your retina. And that chemical reaction was probably only started, maybe only 5% complete, when another image of sight came through the pupil of my eye onto my retina. I had to deal with that. The colors hadn't properly formed. The detail wasn't there. When I got out and walked slowly, the images which fell on my retina, the back of my eye, were slower. They had more time to complete the chemical reaction and for my brain to actually appreciate and see the image. That's why just walking, you saw so much more and so much more beauty. But of course nothing matched standing perfectly still. And just standing there, the eyes open, not moving, and just seeing just the hillside just open up, and the greens, the blues, the browns, the greys were just more beautiful than I'd ever seen before. It's like they'd been polished. And the detail, the textures, everything was just so clear. That would only happen when you know how to move slowly and to stop. When you stop, so much beauty opens up. So much joy, so much happiness. Because you're seeing things now more with your mind. It's the mind which adds the beauty to it. The body has gone slow. The mind now picks up. And so it's wonderful experiences. So when you do start cultivating your mind through stillness, through slowness, taking off the clothes of this emperor, so the emperor is free and can see so much more joy, happiness, so much more power for your own happiness and well-being. It's one of the most luckiest things, you might say lucky, good karma, fortune, I don't know, to learn how to meditate and keep your mind really still. There's so much joy and happiness as a result of that. Nature and the power of the mind. And of course there's much more to say about the mind. But for that, it should be to people who have meditated a lot, who really appreciate what I've been saying about how powerful this mind is, how full of joy it is, and how it can teach you so much more. So you never need to feel afraid of death. Never even need to feel afraid of sickness. So much more to this, and that you learn from understanding the emperor, the nature of your mind. Oh, I'm really getting into this, but it's 9:10, so I should stop now. So thank you all for listening. Now we're going to have some questions, and hopefully some decent answers. You never know what question's going to come, so I never know what the answer's going to be. So let's have a see. Thank you. Oh, good, excellent. I'm very happy to have more questions because usually I mention to people we have 3 questions on this little machine, the tablet, and then I talk to people who have come to the session. But because here it's COVID, so we kind of have the usual crowd, afterwards I can just go straight back to my room. So from here, so I can answer more questions online. The first, Eva from Cambridge. Hi Ajahn Brahm, that's a Cambridge Oriental University. Have you ever had out-of-body experience? Now whenever you say personal experience, I've got to be very careful on these, because sometimes I give too much away already. Out-of-the-body experience is when you leave your body. I know a person who has out-of-body. This is actually how I get out of breaking any rules. You're not supposed to sort of say anything which will make people think you're special. Out-of-the-body experience is when you have these out-of-body experiences. At first, you think, wow, this is really interesting, but you soon get quite bored. And it's also... I'm not interested in watching movies or going to football matches in an out-of-the-body experience. There's no football matches on at the moment anyway, so it's a waste of time. But also, you've got to be very careful because I have, like many people, just have this sense of what's right and what's wrong, the level of virtue. It'd be a rotten thing to actually to go and just say, check up on my monks. I wonder what they're doing this evening, my monks. Are they really meditating or are they just lazing around in their cooties? It's like, you know, having a CCTV camera which no one can really know. You can just go and watch people. It reminded me, there was this Burmese gentleman many, many years ago, and he told me just how he had his job in air conditioning and, you know, just doing contracts. He had a job in Darwin. So he was in Darwin, and his English wife was in Cannington somewhere. And, you know, he was, you know, he really loved his wife. He's a very good man, but he's incredibly jealous. So every now and again, he was over in Darwin, and he'd come and visit his wife, you know, in his astral body, just to check up that she wasn't misbehaving. And she didn't have none of those powers or anything. But she would know, because he was the husband, he would know, okay, it was Simon. That wasn't his name, he had another name, but I don't want to give the game away who this was. Oh, he said, Simon, look, I'm faithful to you. Go back to Darwin and go back to work. And it was true. You know, he'd sort of tell her afterwards that he was actually visiting, just to check it up that she was okay. You know, it's just out-of-body experiences. So that's something which... You know, you don't want to invade people's privacy. From Melbourne, I am a very sociable person. I am finding quarantine very hard without seeing anyone. What advice do you have to me? Please help. Get into your astral body. And you can go anywhere. And the police can't catch you. You can go and watch movies. You can go and see your friends. You can have an astral body party. Is that social? I don't know. The idea is quite sort of interesting. So, because, you know, you're in your room there and just your body's there, but your mind is somewhere else. You're a very sociable person, quieting hard without seeing anyone. One of the persons you can always see is yourself. And that's really important to have this self-love. It's my brother, Tony, he sent me an email, just haven't heard from you, okay, is COVID okay in Western Australia, because you don't get much news of Western Australia, all the news over there is UK. I said, no trouble at all, but what do you expect? We're used to social quarantine as monks. This is, you know, usual practice for us, staying in your room and hut for weeks on end. So, but what's the difference? How come monks, the social quarantine or being with lots of people, I live a very weird life? Because sometimes I can do 6 months without seeing any human being, and not speaking, that 6 month retreat I did. And then you come out and maybe 3 or 4 months later, be in sort of Indonesia with 3 or 4 thousand people, you know, talking to them, signing books and saying hello, and just it's like you go to extremes. I'm not supposed to stay the middle way, but you can stay in total solitude or, you know, be some like rock star monk. But anyway, so how come as a monk you can be with many, many people or by yourself, equally happy? And the reason is, it's always because when you are in quarantine, you're by yourself. There's always someone there. And that's you. And I made a point, and they call it these days self-love, of being a good friend to myself. Never being hard on myself, never being critical. Of course I make mistakes and say the wrong thing every now and again. Actually too often probably. But you don't find fault with yourself. You don't try and escape from yourself. So, you know, you're in your room, in your hut, in my cave actually, and I just enjoy my own company. When you go and have to speak with one of the monks, you enjoy the friendship of your monks. When you go and just check up on the builder doing some work in the monastery, you're friendly to the builder. You're friendly to yourself. It's just with many people or with by yourself. It's the whole idea of loving kindness, joy, peace, being in the moment. That's what I call loving this moment. So, if you're finding quarantine very hard without seeing anyone, what you're seeing is suffering, wanting, being separated from where you are. So how about seeing the positive sides of quarantine? What you can do in Melbourne, a standard little technique, is get a piece of paper, put a vertical line down the middle. On the left-hand side, write all the things you hate about quarantine, all the difficulties, all the terrible parts of living in quarantine, all the stuff which drives you mad and crazy and nuts, not being able to see your friends. Write that all down on the left-hand side. It'll only take you a few seconds. Actually, more than that, but, you know, easy to fill in. And then on the right-hand side, all the benefits and positives of being in quarantine. Say, there aren't any. Yes, there are. Write one or two down. Don't have to go to work. Don't have to, if you've got a car, you don't have to be in traffic jams, or you don't have to be in buses, or wait for buses. You don't have to get caught in the wet. Write all the positives down about being in quarantine. Until you fill up that side too. You find once you get one or two or three positive things about being in quarantine, you can think of many more. But until you get those first three or four down, it's very difficult. Once you've done that, get out the pair of scissors, cut the piece of paper in half down that vertical line down the middle, all the things you hate about quarantine, throw that in the rubbish bin. All the things you like about quarantine, the positives, photocopy it many times. Laminate it, put it in different places in your house, leave it around the place, in your garden, always to remind you of the positives in life. In India, my mother wants me to perform religious activities at temples and bow before God. I find these activities dry without in my heart. I always argue with her, please advise. I don't know if it's an Indian tradition, but it's a Western tradition, a Thai tradition. Most traditions, we always argue with our family members, especially when we get old. Argue with your mother, argue with your father, or whatever. But always remember, just how long is your mother going to be there with you? So if that's what she wants to do, please you go and do it with her. It's not in your heart to maybe bow before in a temple or before a god or something, but isn't it in your heart to love your mum? Just do it because of her. It's not loving God, it's loving your mum. You do that then, mum, because I love you. So, and after a while, she won't be there forever in your life. Be a time either you get married and you go to another place, get a job somewhere else. But while you're with your mum, just be kind to her. And I say that because, you know, the funeral today, her mother passed away, and I told the children, always remember your mum and do some of the things which she liked to do, the good things she liked to do. Even if you don't think it's appropriate because it's not your sort of thing, but that was your mum. So do it for her. From Portugal, how can we reconcile with living with the fear of the virus and try to live a relatively normal life? Well, the virus won't be there forever. And just don't let the virus get into your mind. The virus can only attack the body. The mind is something totally different. And you can see other people, even some people who have the virus. This is from Portugal, so they're harder hit than places like Perth, Australia, but still, it's a saying of the Buddha, even though your body is sick, don't let your mind be sick. Even though your body is sick, don't let your mind be sick. In other words, you see some of the gorgeous, beautiful stuff, and having the virus, this too will pass. And don't just focus on the virus. There's so many other beautiful things happening in a gorgeous country like Portugal. It's May, it's the springtime, it's coming up to summer there. The trees must be gorgeous. The animals, sunshine. Have a look at that. And then you put the virus in perspective. The old story, how big is my hand? My hand is so big, I can't see anybody. All I can see is my hand. Is it the fact my hand is too big? Is that the problem? Or is it because I'm holding it too close to myself? Like some people hold the virus problem too close. That's all they see. They can see no other joy, no other peace, no other thing beyond the virus. Put your hand out here where it belongs. That's where your hand belongs. Now my hand hasn't diminished in size, but I can see so much more. Once it is, I've got perspective. So you can live life. You know that people would tell me over in Auschwitz, that people would still crack jokes, have fun, even though they knew they'd probably die that following day. It's wonderful how human beings can relate to such difficulties. Of course, many more people died there. Even my family, parents and grandparents, would tell me about life in London during the Second World War, during the Blitz, where a bomb fell right next to a terrace house, the next terrace house where my mother and grandma were. People in the next house are neighbours. They were instantly killed. My mother had her arm lacerated. She hardly remembers it, but it happened apparently. And these were the old terrace houses, you know, which was only maybe 5 meters wide, 6 meters wide, to the next house. And they said there were some of the most wonderful times when, even though many people were dying, there was so much kindness and help and joy, and even joy as well. So, that's how you reconcile living with the fear of the virus, is you live life. I told a story today, it's an old Buddhist story. This is a funeral which I went to. I held up a cup of water, a glass of water, and said, "Can you see the crack in the glass?" Because Ajahn Chah told me this story. Because when he told it to me, he said, "I can't see any crack in this glass, it's a pretty good glass." He said, "The crack is microscopic. It's there. It's a crack of fragility, impermanence, anicca. One day someone will drop this glass and that crack will open up and this glass will die." He said, "If this glass was plastic, if it couldn't break, that meant we wouldn't need to care for this glass. Because it's got a crack, because it will break one day, that's why we have to care for it, look after it, and not treat it heedlessly, just like human beings. COVID virus, like many other things in life, just reminds us that we have this crack of fragility inside each one of us. And one day each one of us will die, so many different reasons. But that teaches us the importance of caring. Even today at the funeral service, I told the children, look, this is teaching you. You have to care for one another and care for your family and friends. We don't know how much longer we have together. It's probably many, many more years. But COVID reminds us it could only be another 14 days or even less. We've probably got many more years, but care for one another and value each day. And don't take days or weeks for granted, as we would do beforehand. And from Italy, does Buddhism have an explanation on why we sometimes dream things that actually happen in real life after that? The usual explanation, which I give people, and again, as well as being a Buddhist monk and meditator, I was also a member of the Psychic Research Society, where we investigated with as much science as we could give to things like this. And most times we do dream of many, many things, but sometimes they don't happen. We forget about them. But sometimes we dream of something that actually does happen. When it does happen, that's the one we remember. So is it just a natural process of only remembering the amazing things, or is there something else going on there? And I did tell the monks, only about a week ago, actually less than that. It was the 5th of May, a few days ago. And the 5th of May reminded me of one of those amazing stories about this gentleman here in Perth, quite many years ago now. Well, this is the last question here, so I don't mind just going off with a... Oh no, there's another one afterwards. Anyway, I've already started the story. That he had a dream in the middle of the night. Actually, not middle of the night, because early in the morning here in Perth. And his dream was he dreamt of these 5 angels. These 5 like devas, angels. And they each had 5 big pots of gold. And they queued up and they gave him 25 pots of gold. That was his dream. And then as soon as he received his last pot of gold, he woke up. He looked around the bedroom. It was morning time. He couldn't see any angels in his bedroom, but worse, he didn't mind not seeing angels, but he really missed the pots of gold. And so he thought, it was just a dream. But when he went down to breakfast, he found that morning his wife had made him 5 pieces of toast and 5 boiled eggs, which was weird. What's with the number 5? He looked at the newspaper, 5th of May. And just, you know, wondering what was going on, he decided to look at the horse racing pages. Here in Perth, there is a horse racing course. It's named after a big one in England called Ascot. A-S-C-O-T. Five letters. So he looked at the fifth race that afternoon. And he looked down the fifth horse in the fifth race. He just couldn't believe his eyes. The horse was called Five Angels. The horse Five Angels was running on the 5th of May in Ascot, and he just dreamt of Five Angels giving him this huge fortune in gold. If you do have these experiences, you only have them once in your life. So he decided to take the afternoon off work. He went to the bank to keep the lucky number five, $5,000 out of the bank. A lot of money, $5,000. He went to the racetrack. He chose the fifth bookmaker in line. He said $5,000 to win horse number five, race number five, Five Angels. He knew the lucky number five couldn't go wrong. And the lucky number five didn't go wrong. His horse came in fifth. Oh. So sometimes we do have the dreams, and we can misinterpret them. That's the problem. But sometimes those dreams actually do work out. Okay, are we running short of time? I can tell this other real story. This is a true story. Because this is family. I asked my mother while she was still alive, and asked my auntie, who actually is still alive. She's in her 90s now. Did this really happen? I said, yeah, it did. And this is like your own mother and your auntie. They grew up as almost like sisters. And because when they were still just after the Second World War, they were young and they were looking for partners in life. So my auntie and my mum, they went together to this medium. You know, just for fun, just to see what was going on. And this medium took one look at my auntie, and her name was Opal, and said, "You are soon going to meet your husband." Now, if somebody says that to you, you know, think, oh, the guy's crazy. What was a woman medium? I'm not sure. But anyway, oh, yeah. And he said, and his name will be first name Donald, surname Wolfreys. Now, Donald was not a uncommon name, but Wolfreys, the surname, was really uncommon. So I said, what did you think about when it said that was rubbish, you know, stupid, but it was no good fun. But then, about a week later, she met this, and I asked her, what happened? She said, I met this nice guy at a dance. That's what they used to do in those days. And, you know, he asked me for a dance. I said, yes. And so, what's your name? And he said, Donald. Uh-oh. Surname was Wolfreys. They were married 60 years. He only died about 2 or 3 years ago. 60 years they were married. And I kept on asking, was that happened? He said, oh, yeah, that happened. And it just said, they weren't, I was always shocked by it, but they weren't at all. So anyway, we want an explanation for that. I don't know. Is that karma, maybe? But how did that medium know that? Ooh. Anyway, the next one. How do we observe the thinking mind which is watching an object, for example, anger, conjuring with an unpleasant thought? This is the knowing mind. If you see anger, a lot of times you never don't see yourself. When you get angry, you always see the object of the anger. It's him, it's her, or it's the bus, or it's the government. You notice that anger, your attention is outside of you. If you could only just know what your anger is doing to you personally, that's shocking. I'm angry, it's his fault, it's her fault, it's his government's fault, it's Buddhist Society of West Australia. They make me work really hard. I'm, you know, supposed to be COVID time, so I was having a rest. This Buddhist Society, and I'm not at all aware of what I'm doing to myself. I'm only aware of just the object of my anger outside somewhere. It's one of the reasons why one of the best ways to overcome anger is just holding the mirror of mindfulness in front of you. What's it doing to you? And then you find you can't sustain anger. So if you really are observe the thinking mind. The thinking mind just always deceives you. You know, yes, we think of how we've been taught, what we've been told, not what's actually real. So much. An example of that is when I was a student, smart little conceited young man, and I learned astronomy. That was astrophysics. That was one of my areas. I joined the Astronomy Society as well. And I knew all these names of all the stars and the constellations and stuff. And when I became a monk, sometimes on clear days, you look up in the heavens, and I knew the name of the stars, but I couldn't see their beauty anymore. And it took me years, deliberately, a lot of effort to actually forget the names. So I can, especially at a place like in Serpentine or over in Jhana Grove, and you can sort of sit down there and watch the Milky Way. I know the name Milky Way, but what star is what and just how big they are and whether that's a galaxy there or a nebula or whatever. Forget about all of that and then I can see its beauty. Do you really need to know names to see beauty? I think it's much nicer not to know. That's for me anyway. So the thinking mind usually takes you away from reality. You go into thoughts. So it's nice having a mind which is silent. Doesn't give things names, which means that you don't measure them, you don't judge them, they just are, and you appreciate their joy and beauty. Much nicer. As a monk, you're supposed to look after and teach a lot of people, and just many people come and see you. But you try not to judge anyone. Isn't it nice? Sometimes people you've seen many, many times, you don't know their names. Sometimes I think, is that really a fault in me? No, I think sometimes names, they take away from the reality. Anyway, so a knowing mind, a mind which knows is a mind which is silent in the present moment. It doesn't need to put things in words. A knowing mind doesn't judge. It doesn't judge enough to give a word to something. And so is the best minds. Peaceful, beautiful, enjoys beauty. Okay, that's been going on a long time. So now, I've got into the habit ever since the COVID time of giving a blessing instead of just an ordinary chant at the end. So I'm now going to give the usual after the Friday night talk blessing.
Sabba Roga Vinimuto, Sabba Santapa Vajito, Sabba Viramati Gando, Nibhuto chatu vang bhava sabhiti yo viva chantu sabha rogo vinasatu mate bhavan vantarayo sukhi digayu gopava Apivadanha silitsa nichan vutapachalino chataro dhamma vatanti ayuvano sukhang bhalam.
Good night, everybody, or good morning, depending on what country you're in. And be strong, stay safe, and be healthy.